Like you said, one, we've been doing a series focusing on pausing within the last words of Christ. Part of the reason we're doing this is to introduce Lent. And just because I skipped three notes on my slides, good morning. Welcome to Coast Hills. In case you don't know who I am, I'm Glenn. I'm part of the teaching team. If it seems like I'm spacey and distant around you, that's usually because I am. It's not intentional. I just am very distracted by what goes on in my own head. Hello. Thank you for joining. And I am honored to be part of the teaching team because this is where we get to cultivate different voices to be able to reimagine the way we enter not only the text, but community. Because it's by community hermeneutic, or the way the community reads, that we learn to engage with each other's stories in such a way that something more beautiful can come. One voice can never achieve the beauty that a community can. So in preparation for what we've been doing, we've been in the Lent season, which is the time in the church calendar going up towards the crucifixion and Easter. This week, the fifth week, is called Passion Sunday. And passion is the term for the suffering. So it times well with this part of John, because this is the part of the calendar in which we descend into the darkness of suffering, where Jesus' mission, Jesus' claim to be king, hits a small snag when he dies. And that's the exploration of today, is that moment when in the same breath, hope, God, and king die. Most of us hear this story, but we hear it as future insiders. We hear it with the notion that, I'm sorry, I'm too short. I need to stand up here because I can't see half of you. But we hear it from the notion that all will be well, Easter has come, resurrection is a given thing. We have paused in the series on the last word so that we can say, we're going to step into it as though we're the characters within the Gospels, and we don't know resurrection is coming. We descend into darkness in the moment that your concept of God, your hope for this life, you hit that moment that the good person dies, the family falls apart, everything you would hope for completely comes to nothing. You've worked, you've suffered, you've strove, and then in a moment, government takes it. And this is what we're stepping into. So if you missed the last few weeks, I'm really excited for today because I got to choose which passage I dealt with. And I fanboyed the Gospel of John, because if you like the other ones, I'm really glad. They are also quality. They're called the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They're just not as fun. John is where everything is good. And the irony is we always tell people, hey, you're new to Christianity, read John. It's the hardest one to read. It has the most subtle use of scripture. It doesn't do miracles, it does signs. It doesn't have direct quotations. You're just supposed to be able to hear key words that use once. You're like, oh, of course that's a whole book. How could I miss that? And that's the Gospel of John. So we're going to begin with the text, which is John 19, and we're going to be a little bit wider, 23 to 31. Then we're going to narrow our focus to 28 to 30. Because that's going to be the key point where today's last words, which it is finished, is going to be unpacked a little bit. And we'll finish with a time of riffing in order to take the text, try to make it impact our life. And that is the only time the notes on the back of your handout come into play for the first two sections. Look at them if you want. You can play my game, try to see if you can guess how I would have filled it out. But it's going to be in that flow from text to some commentary. And just know, there's a lot going on in this passage. You have about eight different ways you can read this passage with its relation to other scripture, within to itself, and the wider meanings. We're choosing one, so this isn't the last word. This is a word. And if it reflects, if it responds to you, that's great. But we do not get the exhaustive meaning of the text. We get to sit into this one moment, this one sound, and see if our stories can resonate. So since Kevin prayed, I'll skip that part. So now pause, we're going to read the text, John 19:23. Now when the soldiers crucified Jesus, They took his clothes and made four shares, one for each soldier, and the tunic remained. Now the tunic was seamless, woven from top to bottom as a single piece. So the soldiers said to one another, "Let us not tear it, but throw dice to see who will get it." This took place to fulfill the scriptures that says, "They divided my garments among them. For my clothing they threw dice." So the soldiers did these things. Now standing beside Jesus' cross were his mother's sister Mary, the wife of Clopas, Mary Magdalene. So when Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing there, he said to his mother, "Woman, look, here is your son." He then said to the disciple, "Look, here is your mother." From that very time, the disciple took her into his own home. After this, Jesus, realizing that by this time everything was completed, in order to fulfill the scriptures, he said, "I am thirsty." A jar full of sour wine was there, so they put a sponge soaked in sour wine on a branch of hyssop and lifted it to his mouth. When he had received the sour wine, Jesus said, "It is completed." Then he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. Then, because it was the day of preparation, so that the body should not stay on the crosses on Sabbath, for that Sabbath was an especially important one, the Jewish leaders asked Pilate to have the victim's legs broken and the bodies taken down. So moving through that scene, you can feel it kind of like at the last battle in any action movie, when the focus tightens from an entire battlefront to a few people in conflict. Everything else darkens. The peripheral people, the rest of the stage darken, and right now you only have three groups of people. You have Jesus hanging on the cross, and for those of us who the picture of the cross is drawn from Renaissance paintings, the cross was a little more than head high. It was something you could touch. You'd be seeing Jesus about here, because they wanted you to feel it. Then you use the same locative verb for distancing of the soldiers and the group that is his mother, his aunt, his beloved disciple. And that's where the screen just kind of tightens, because where we want to sit is in this moment. For the moment that there is no people, following the list of names, it's the beloved disciple. Now, what's very unique about the beloved disciple in the passage is everyone else gets a name. They're like, it's his mom, it's his aunt who married this person, Mary Magdalene. And then suddenly when you get to the one person not in that group, it says, and the beloved disciple, which has raised a lot of debate. But mainly the debate has been, who is the beloved disciple? But pulling from some of the rabbinic tradition, I'd want to be able to pause and intentionally read into this moment. Because the question of who is misses the power of the statement. Because it is the named beloved disciple. And I'd say looking out, if we're going to be sitting within the text, that'd be the place to read yourselves. You are the beloved disciple. At the foot of the cross, where all darkness is falling, where God and man die in one breath, where chaos wins, you are the beloved disciple. When you're not sure where things are going, you'd say, if God was with us, it could not go this way. You are the beloved disciple. And in this moment, he speaks to the beloved. And in this, like Kevin unpacked last week, what is that community? I'm not going to do that to you. You had one sermon last week. If you missed it, listen to it. But there's a really important thing here. Jesus prays in John 17, in case you're not familiar with the structure of John, John 13, 33 to 18, 2 is his last word, just kind of these high statements. It's what he wants to give the community just before it comes to the crucifixion. And in this, Jesus prays. In 17, 23, he says, "Father, grant it that I be in them as you are in me, in order that they may become completely one, in order that the world may know that you sent me and you love them as you've loved me." You have that prayer. And it's almost as though Jesus first prays to God, but then prays to the community. That may sound sacrilegious, but to pray is to entreat, to call forth. It's not always rooted in the immensely sacred, one-directional kind of burning of something. It's the plea. It's a relational stance. Jesus calls to God and says, could this be, could they be one? And then on the cross, and this is the only place it's mentioned in the Bible, in this moment of tragedy, you actually have everything else pause. The soundtrack in the movie goes silent as you can hear Jesus' hoarse whisper to his disciples, take my mother in. He prays that they can be one, and on the cross, in this one scene, he answers his own prayer by calling to the community in darkness to be drawn towards each other, and it's seen as the opening of their homes. And we'll get to how that's linked so tightly a little bit later. And then going towards the end, because we're going to be camping on 28 to 30. So in 31, because it was the preparation day, so that the bodies should not stay on the crosses during Sabbath, for that Sabbath was an especially important one. Now, 26 to 27 calls for a new family lines, which is actually characteristic of the first few hundred years of Christianity. How it moved was the weirdest expansion of family lines by including all the people in society who didn't have a social safety net. The church was proactive in adopting orphans who had nobody, taking in widows who didn't have an inheritance, and going to plague victims who their own families had abandoned. So that first call of Jesus to the community in darkness was a call of togetherness, of presence. And then at the last scene, it gives you this hint in darkness and said, didn't you know? A very important Sabbath. That is a parenthetical statement. It's a voice from the narrator, and this is the thing you must know. If you want meaning in a text, listen to your narrator's voice. Everything else is just an event. Without the narrator, you have a would-be Messiah get killed by the state, and you're good. He said he was thirsty. Of course, he'd just been flogged and then nailed to a cross. It dries you out. It's only with the narrator's voice that depth is given to the passage. And in 31, when it says, the Sabbath was an especially important one, you're anticipating the seventh day of creation, because that's what frames the whole narrative of John. So listen to the narrator through this passage. In verse 23, it said, the throwing of the dice took place so that scriptures could be fulfilled. In 26, when Jesus saw the disciple whom he loved standing there. In 28, Jesus realizing everything is completed. Then goes into 29. He said, in order to fulfill scripture. And then in 31, all the tragedy has happened, but we're anticipating the dawn of Sabbath. Because the narrator wants you to see in the tragedy the seed of hope that does not do away with the darkness you descend into. So finally, we're ready to enter into 28 to 30. I don't want to rush past this moment, past the death of God. We stand in place of the beloved disciple who cannot see the last chapter. We stand in the place of one who had hopes of the restoration, and everything fell. After this, Jesus, realizing that by this time everything was completed, said, in order to fulfill the scriptures, I'm thirsty. A jar full of sour wine was there, so they put a sponge soaked in sour wine on a branch of hyssop and lifted it to his mouth. When he had received the sour wine, Jesus said, it is completed. Then bowed his head and gave up his spirit. Again, there's a lot happening, even in those three verses. Just to let you know, there are four different textual echoes there. We can't deal with all of them because you probably want to leave before lunchtime is over. But in this, we're going to deal with one. Realizing that by this time, everything was completed as a full statement points back to the full purposes of God. But also, we don't want to get just lost in the cosmological. We don't want to get lost in the big story and forget the immediate, the sentence right before it. part of the all things being completed was reframing family in the darkness where God and hope dies. That was part of the all things. It also points back to the whole story of created order, of a God present, bringing things in. But sometimes we let go of one for the other. So all things being completed is saying, you are family, you are the beloved disciple. I am thirsty, which quotes Psalm 69, a psalm of despair where the king is drowning in a chaotic sea. It begins with, I sink into deep mire. There is no solid ground. I am in deep water. The current overpowers me. God will deliver Zion. Descendants of his servants will inherit it. Now, the I am thirsty, as I said, would be expected from the lips of a dying man in midday sun, having been flogged the previous night. It's the narrator's voice that lets you know it's not just a cry of physical need, there's something deeper happening, tying to the messianic hope that a God would show up. And then his last words should be understood with an exclamation point. It's not a whisper falling out of nowhere. It would seem rather mysterious. It would seem rather enigmatic if you are the beloved disciple standing before your king on a cross dying, and he says, don't worry, it's completed. Because that's not quite the way a revolution's supposed to win. But this is the moment, because in this moment, it pulls one of the most prominent narratives of John. Because in John, creation, the act of Genesis 1 should be echoing in the back of your mind to where there are chaotic seas that cannot produce life. They already exist. Because in Genesis 1, water is there, land is there, all the materials that could create life are already present. It's not a creation from nothing in Genesis 1. It's a creation from chaos. Because the storming seas and things of life could not create something that sustained life. So you have the Creator God existing over it. In the same way for John, you're not entering into nothing. Jesus becomes incarnate, and he comes into an already pre-existing Roman peace that is death of your enemy. There is chaos, there is pain, but there's not always a way to produce life. And so in John 1:1, it uses the phrase the same as Genesis 1:1 in the Greek Old Testament. But in Genesis, it would say, in the beginning, God made. In John 1:1, in the beginning would echo there. It says, in the beginning was the Word. And it goes on to say how the Word brought light and the light overcame darkness. Jumping to 1928 and 30, it uses the verb of completion, teleo. And it links because it says, and all things were completed, to where in Genesis 2:1, the ending of the first creation account, it says on day six, in the time of all things being created. And it said the heavens and the earth, all of the cosmos, and cosmos would be all created things that could give life, all order and structure, all people and systems have become created. And they've been brought to purpose. And it's in that moment that that verb gets applied to what Jesus said, because where it says all was created, you have just before Jesus is about to die, he says, I see that all things have been brought to completion, using the same wording. It just, in this time, it's not the primordial sea God exists over. It's the Roman violence and the hope of an insurrectionist. Also in John, you have six signs pointing to a seventh. You have the water into wine in chapter 2, the healing of chapter 4, healing by the pool of Bathsheba in 5, the fish and loaves being multiplied in chapter 6, the man born blind given sight in 9, then Lazarus is the last sign pointing to what Jesus is going to do in chapter 11. 6 days waiting for the seventh sign. Now, for us, these numbers might not mean a lot, but within the Jewish storytelling, within Genesis, the sixth day was the final day of creation that they are whispering, Sabbath is coming, which is why it's so amazing that right after it, unlike any of the other Gospels, you have in the words of the leading Jewish figures trying to honor kosher laws by removing dead bodies, saying, do you not know? It's a very important Sabbath. So 6 days have passed. The Creator exists over chaos to bring life. But in the Gospel of John, chaos rises with creation to kill the Creator. In one person, one breath, God, King, and hope have died. But the narrator promises a very important Sabbath is coming. Rest is coming. The day that all things are set to right and the darkness that you now witness will be the memory as opposed to the reality. But we must wait. Because in Passion Sunday, resurrection hasn't happened yet. On the sixth day, Sabbath has not dawned. We sit in that tension between what we could hope for if only we listened to the narrator's voice and our current reality of pain, turmoil, blah, but of pain, suffering, and hopes deferred. So at this point, we're going to move into the riffing, to where it's not going to be direct reading, so we were in a moment of dealing with the literal readings of the text. But now we're going to say, how do we step into the story? And I'd like just to give permission in this, because I can just say from within my own faith tradition, the way I was raised in church, often you could only deal with the concept of pain, shortcomings, and things if you're past it, never in current. And if you're in them, you were supposed to paint them as very rosy pictures, that you know everything is terrible right now, but I will be good. I'd like to say wherever you are in your faith journey, however you're processing the way you relate to God and community, your doubt, your pain, your angst, your uncertainty, if you're not sure what to do with the biblical text or the religious community, it's valid. And we do not exist in the denial of them. Rather, we grow by the experiencing of them. And by actually leaning in and giving yourself a moment to pause in the darker emotions, you get to experience something beautiful. They do not overwhelm. They do not drown you. You're not fully lost in them. So, point one, if you're going to keep notes on the back. You are the beloved disciple. Therefore, answer Jesus' prayer by choosing presence over distraction. Descending into darkness was not a sign that you were no longer the beloved disciple, but it was by proximity to Jesus that that disciple, the beloved one, experienced the true blood, sweat, and pain of his hope. Proximity to glory, proximity to the one we would call God, is actually what brought him into a place of ultimate darkness and saying, it's not real. So I'd like to say, if at times, like me, you experience some pain, some angst, some moments where your family doesn't just quite go the way it should, the way things don't quite play out the way that you had invested in them, it is not a sign you're not the beloved. That is still true. You are the beloved disciple, but you must choose presence over distraction. I put over because there will be times you choose distraction. And there's two types of distraction. And I'd say it's seen in the Roman soldiers who are at the same distance from the cross as the beloved disciple, throwing dice in order to see how do we pick the bones, the one executed. Because there is a complicit form of distraction. Things are what they are. We can't do anything about them, so I might as well get what I can have now. And we are numb to the violence around us. We're numb to the story of a people oppressed. We're numb to any of the events, even the ones that our own hands have done, like the soldiers. And our distraction is a lack of engagement around us. But there's another kind of distraction, at least in my experience, this is the one we generally do in church the most. An escapist distraction. I don't have to deal with what's in front of me because I'll get to heaven, it'll be cool. I don't have to deal with what's in front of me. God will take care of it. I don't have to be present because I can delay it and escape to whatever fantasy it is. Where I've seen this the most, which was always odd to me, was when I worked at a mill. almost every person there over 55 were still talking about the job they're going to take and why this is only a temporary situation. And I was like, sir, you're counting down the last decade to retirement. The ship on new probably sailed. But that was the way they stayed at peace with their job. They didn't like their job. They spoke no love for the job. But you don't get it. I can escape this reality. So to be present is not to escape, but to actually sit in that moment of pain. So presence is witness in the beloved disciple who stood in shock with those others who are shocked and responded to the need and moved towards people. From that day forward, from that hour it actually specifies forward, Mary lived in his house. So when darkness falls, move towards people and respond to the need by being present. And that presence doesn't mean you fix. It just means rather than choosing distraction that goes to isolation, you choose actually seeing the pain so that you can exist with people in community. It means that we don't have to have the last word, the final word, the ultimate way to fix. At times, it'll be seen as just breaking bread and saying, wow, that's heavy. I don't know how we'll get through the darkness, but in this moment, I am with you in. Which brings me to point two. We grow by passing through, not in spite of the darkness. Because sometimes we say we want to avoid pain, we want to avoid discomfort, we don't want to have the hard decisions, the hard conversations. And so rather than having the thing that allows us to stay within community and connection, we go around it. But we don't realize, just like in the story in John, the only way that new creation could be birthed, the only way we move from day 6 to day 7 is through the event of the cross. Because it's through, not an avoidance of. But I'd like to take a moment, because this can actually carry some negative thought process. So I want to be very careful with what I'm saying. I am not saying seek out pain, discomfort. I'm not highlighting that as like, oh, do you know how you're really spiritual? You put yourself through pain. I'm saying that is a part of maturity and growth. That is a part of the growing up process that says God is bigger than the childhood fantasies we held, which were good in the time in which we were children. But the ability for us to step into something and to call forth something of the seventh day. And I'd say, lastly, when you're in the darkness, point three, learn to hear the narrator's voice. Sabbath rest is coming. Because when we experience painful moments, and I'd say, at least for myself, and this I just want to qualify as saying, I've been a part of the church for a long time. I've been in biblical studies and academia for a long time. My wife has witnessed moments of me not liking what I study and throwing the book across the room and yelling at it and being like, oh, are you okay? So in this angst and in what I'm saying about hearing the narrator's voice, it's been a long process for me. I have both left and come back to the church. I've both hated and despised as well as cherished and valued the church. So whichever point you are in that spectrum, it's all right. You'll learn to hear the narrator's voice. Because when we experience these painful moments, there's a tendency to select voices that echoes our own. In the same way, when we have a fight with somebody in the family, usually the first person we call is someone else in the family who dislikes that cousin. And we could have that moment of, can you believe what? And they're like, yes, I hate her. Do you know what she did to me? Last Thanksgiving was terrible. And we get into that kind of infighting, the siloed effect. We're like, man, in this angst, when we're not sure because we're in darkness, we're in pain, that notion of the God dying is our chief image, we gravitate towards voices and people's like, you sound exactly like me. We're good. But listening to the narrator's voice is listening to tradition, is listening to hope, is listening to the subtleties that can never be said too loud. Because the narrator has to whisper, because you might not be in the place to take the bold statement. So in these conflicts, whether they're interpersonal or religious, listen to that hope. Rest is coming. Yes, it's day 6. Yes, today's the day creation rose and the Creator died. But that is not the end of the story. a very important Sabbath is coming. So the narrator will be the one who offers you the bigger perspective, one with hope, but without the ability just to simply fix. Because your growth, your maturity, your ability to become more truly a reflection of Christ will be through the darkness. Not in spite of, it's not something to hate, it's something to experience. And in experiencing, walking this backwards, we know we're doing it well if, as the beloved disciple, we don't let go of that name. You are beloved. Even with the one who is loving is hanging from a cross about to be executed. You are loved. And the way we honor, the way we respond, the way we answer the prayer of the one crucified, is we move towards each other. And this is the story of a community thriving when darkness falls. And it'll help us to be able to engage well and not just pass by. And in light of this, we're going to step into communion, because it's a celebration of this event that we point to, of the death and resurrection of Jesus, that we say, if all else is darkness, we stand at the foot of the person who says that Sabbath is coming, the people will be whole. So, Kevin, if you'd please.